This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The GST, a broad-based tax system that is imposed on goods and services at every stage of the supply chain, which typically begins in manufacturing and ends at retail. It is widely considered to be a more efficient tax collection system and one that governments the world over have come to rely on for a large proportion of their revenue. Here in Malaysia, the proposed 6% GST isn't a new tax, but rather a replacement for the existing 10% sales tax and 6% services tax. The GST, it is the only thing we Malaysians have been talking about post-budget 2014. What is it? How does it work? What does it mean for me, my family and my business? There are so many questions, and no doubt in the coming days, weeks and months, we will be furnished with a cacophony of voices, each one providing any number of opinions on the matter, from how it should work to how it should be implemented, on whether or not it's a good tax, on what the ideal rate should be, a multitude of voices engaged in vibrant debate. My name is Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan, and today I'm going to add six more voices to the mix. This is Here and Now in Malaysia, brought to you by the Economic Transformation Programme, and on this week's show, we're going global. There are currently 160 countries around the world that have implemented the Goods and Services Tax, GST, or Value Added Tax, VAT, as it is called in some places, and I'll be speaking to experts from there in an attempt to ascertain just how the GST has worked out for them. Six individuals, academics, analysts, and tax experts from South Africa, Singapore, Australia, the United Kingdom, and Canada. We will be taking a broad look at GST across the world with a focus on two particular and crucial issues. In part one, we will be looking at questions of implementation, the ideology behind zero-rated products and exemptions, as well as those criticisms of the GST being a regressive tax. And then, in part two of our program, we'll be asking that oh-so-contentious question of whether or not 6% GST is enough. Should it be higher? Should it be lower? Before finally tackling some potential problems and pitfalls that we should be mindful of as we ourselves approach D-Day. Why am I going global? Well, because that's precisely what our government did when coming up with our proposed GST plan. Here's Robert Tsang, Deloitte's indirect tax leader for Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific, with a little bit of history.
The government here spent lots of time looking at systems in different countries, both here in Asia and around the world. The most compelling examples, I understand, were the European Union framework, the VAT system that exists in countries like the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, states of the European Union were an important precedent. There was also a lot of input taken from the Australian GST system, and like Malaysia, had a previous history of other taxes similar to the sales tax and the service tax. Singapore, being so close to Malaysia, also had a lot of things in the system that the Ministry of Finance here and Customs took a lot of input on. Just to complete the picture, Canada, with its federal versus provincial GST and provincial sales tax, that's something that our government looked at very closely as well. And you could not say for any system that Malaysia is exactly the same as Vietnam or China. It's really a hybrid.
A hybrid with a number of features adopted from all over the world, creating a uniquely Malaysian system that will descend upon us on April 1st, 2015, when we join the other 160 countries all around the world with the implementation of our 6% GST. Now, we all knew the GST was coming. It wasn't a matter of if, but when. But what is the GST and why have all these countries jumped on the bandwagon? Michael Evans is a senior fellow in the Faculty of Law at the University of Melbourne. He is also the chairman of the Institute of Chartered Accountants in Australia's Indirect Taxes Committee. Here he is with a quick and dirty definition.
What the economic theory is, as a tax base, you ought to have household final consumption expenditure. That should be your tax base. Why? Because that, in theory, continues without the type of ups and downs that you get in income taxes and direct taxes. It's in theory a more reliable and robust base. This is household consumption expenditure over the lifetime of people. So while at some stage your expenditure might be less because your income's less, as you get older, then you're still spending the theory has it, the economists will say, that consumption, household consumption expenditure is a better, more reliable and fairer base upon which you pay tax over your lifetime.
There is an obvious question that follows. Is GST just one of those economic inevitabilities?
Yes. At some point, once countries reach a certain stage of development, governments have more and more responsibilities and things to do, and typically they have to raise a significant amount of taxes. And you have to do that using a number of different tax bases. So you can tax income, you can tax the sales of goods and services, property, possibly even wealth. But yes, I think if you look at all of the middle and high income countries across the world, they have these broad-based taxes.
That was Rod Hill, professor of economics at the University of New Brunswick in St. John and author of the acclaimed Economics Anti-Text book. And his yes was echoed by everyone else we spoke to. But what about specific to us here in Malaysia? Here's Fung Siu, regional editor and Malaysia expert at the Economist Intelligence Unit in London.
In Malaysia's case, yes, because Malaysia has been living beyond its means, if you like, for nearly two decades now. They have actually posted a budget deficit nearly every single year, or almost for the last 15 years. But at some stage, the demographics will switch around, whereby you will have a population that will be aging, and that will place enormous burdens on welfare and also healthcare systems as well. So you do need to be in a good fiscal economic shape to be able to deal with this. Now, with a shrinking population, what you'll find is that revenue collection will be dropping because your labour force is shrinking. So the amount of tax you would collect from these people would be reduced because there's fewer of them working. Now, with a consumption tax, it's a tax that's applied across goods and services. That should, A, broaden your tax revenue base, and B, it should bring in a steady amount of income, assuming that private consumption continues to grow and remains steady. So in a way, going forward, a GST is necessary just to put the economy on a good financial base to deal with shocks in the future, whether it comes from aging population or whether it comes from a financial or global financial shock.
Now, at this point, it is important to address one of the biggest criticisms faced by such broad-based tax systems, in that they are, by and large, regressive. And by that, I mean that any uniform tax, such as the GST, will inevitably hit the lower income group harder. Here's Dermot Gaffney, head of indirect tax at KPMG Australia.
Listen, indirect taxes are regressive. That's a statement of fact and the obvious. It may not be as bad as some people think. The experience in South Africa, for example, was that the impact assessment on low-income families was that they were paying about 3.5% of their income in GST, whereas high-income families were paying 2.5%. So the difference wasn't as big as you might have expected. But it is fundamentally a regressive tax. You minimize that regressive impact by the way in which you apply the zero ratings to staples and foodstuffs and medical care and education. So you can take care of it. But the more exemptions and exceptions you put into the system, then the less efficient it is to administer by reference to the cost of administration over the cost, over the amount of tax collected. You then have to look at the whole tax system and say, is it progressive? And in countries like South Africa, it's still found that by pegging the rates of personal taxes at the right level, it is still overall progressive, i.e. people who earn more contribute more in total taxes. That is a better way to view the tax system rather than just a GST versus corporate income tax or personal tax.
In Malaysia's case, politically, I think the government has always been aware that the low-income groups are a major vote bank. So in that respect, they do need to make sure that the implementation when it comes in is done as thoroughly as possible.
Here's Professor Rod Hill on how to fight the regressive nature of taxes such as the GST.
There's really two ways to try and offset that. One is to attempt to exempt basic necessities, and that can undoubtedly do part of the job. The other way that can be done is to attach sort of like a refundable credit or just a cash transfer to households. It doesn't actually depend on how much they spend. What you can do is you can make an estimate of how much they would be spending, say just based on survey data. And then when you know people's incomes, say from the previous year's income tax, you can determine how much you're going to give them as a cash transfer. So that's not a bad way of attempting to offset the regressiveness of a GST.
So are exemptions and zero-rated products and services the way forward, or is it better to tax everything like they do in New Zealand, for example, and then provide things like rebates and tax credits and other similar forms of assistance?
It seems to depend on the views of people in different cultures as to which route is most acceptable. If you start exempting this and that, you end up, of course, complicating the tax system in the sense that it becomes more difficult to decide, is this particular item some basic food item or is it junk food or whatever? If you look, I think, at the countries of continental Europe, value judgment seems to have been, let's tax everything and sort of go from there. So if you broaden the tax base, you can have a somewhat lower tax rate.
The South African example is an interesting one, where their treasury has, over the years, moved away from zero rates and exemptions and more towards channeling funds for the needy and the poor. Here's André Meyburg, Director of Indirect Tax at KPMG South Africa.
You know, the downside to that is in South Africa, we also have zero rated of certain so-called basic foodstuffs, because you can just imagine that basic foodstuffs or the zero rating thereof was intended clearly to assist the poor. And then you need to try and identify, you know, what would be the typical foodstuffs that they would require or buy, generally speaking. And that becomes difficult because you also have various ethnic groups in South Africa. And the reality is that most cases, there was absolutely no evidence that the zero rate on the basic foodstuffs actually reached the objective that was set, namely to make those foodstuffs more affordable for the poor. And our national treasury has, over many years, decided very firmly that despite all the pushing and lobbying to get further foodstuffs zero rated, to stick with what they have currently and to rather use funds through different processes to assist the needy and the poor.
But zero rates and exemptions can have a positive effect on society as well. Michael Evans argues that zero rates and exemptions are what make GST progressive. Here he is making that point.
Those zero rates and exemptions actually assist in the progressivity, if we want to put it that way. So if those are directed at the percentage of household expenditure that the lower socioeconomic groups spend their money on, and that's the reason for zero rating food and health and education, one of the reasons, is that they will be more dominantly part of the expenditure of the lower socioeconomic groups. If we relieve them from a GST, those groups are paying less as a percentage of their expenditure in tax than the higher income groups.
So by that measure, zero rates and exemptions can be used as a way to forward policy ideals. Feng Xiu makes a similar argument from the UK perspective.
Even in countries like the UK, exemptions already remain in place. We have a value-added tax, which is equivalent to Malaysia's GST, and that is at 20%. But childcare items are exempted from that. So things like children's clothing are exempted. You can argue that really that they shouldn't be because people with earning higher incomes with children shouldn't get the full benefit. But there is a reason behind this. That's because the government would like to promote more births, if you like, so that they're encouraging a growth in population. So there are reasons why certain items are exempted.
Coming up in part two of our episode, what is the optimum tax rate? Is 6% high enough? Is there a sweet spot? I'll be tackling that contentious question, as well as taking a look at some potential implementation problems and pitfalls that we need to be mindful of in the lead up to GST. So don't go anywhere. You're listening to Here and Now in Malaysia, brought to you by the Economic Transformation Programme. You're listening to Here and Now in Malaysia, brought to you by the Economic Transformation Programme. I'm Umapagan Ampakepagan, and today I'm presenting a global perspective on GST. We've spoken about GST being an economic inevitability. We've looked at the ideology behind zero-rated products and exemptions, as well as criticisms of the GST being a regressive tax. Now, before we take a look at some potential problems and pitfalls that we should avoid while implementing GST, let's spend a few minutes on the actual tax rate itself. On April 1st, 2015, the Goods and Services Tax in Malaysia will come in at 6%. Some believe that rate is too low. Here's Feng Xiu, regional editor and Malaysia expert at the Economist Intelligence Unit in London.
In the case of Malaysia, we are talking 6%, but that 6% is low compared to the current taxes already in place. There is a sales and services tax, which is around about 16%. So when the GST comes in, that 16% will drop to 6%. And from that, I would probably argue in Malaysia's case, it should be set even higher, given the fact that their fiscal position is actually still poor. The country is still running a budget deficit equivalent to about 4%, 4 to 5% of GDP. It really needs to narrow this so that it can actually allocate resources more efficiently and better. So I don't think at 6% it's going to do much to actually help the government improve their fiscal finances. If they wanted a major improvement in the fiscal finance, they would have to actually set the GST much higher.
That being said, she does agree that given how contentious GST has been here in Malaysia, 6% is a good start.
Given the fact that this is such a contentious issue in Malaysia, I think 6% is reasonable. This GST planning has been in place for years now. The legislation has been talked about in Parliament, and the last time I looked, in 2009 was when Parliament last debated it. So I think it's a good start. And at some stage, it will be increased. But I think for Malaysians, the fact that the sales and services tax is going to come down from 16% to 6% should, in some ways, temper that implementation and also help the consumers think that, in fact, taxes are coming down rather than going up.
But is there a sweet spot when it comes to fixing such tax rates? Here's Andre Mayberg, Director of Indirect Tax at KPMG South Africa.
Look, I think, at the time, sales tax, or VAT rather, in South Africa started at 12%. That increased to 14%. But I think when you talk rates of tax, it's an extremely difficult topic to discuss in the broader sense and how it works in other countries. I mean, you will know that some of the European countries have much higher rates, 17%, 20%, and so forth on luxury goods. So it's very difficult to pinpoint where the rate should be. However, in order to get to a sort of reasonable number, you clearly need to take in a lot of factors. You know, you need to look at the stage of economic development of the country, spending patterns. Are there going to be any relief offered for example, basic foodstuffs or medical services, whatever that particular country's needs might be? Would it be necessary to impose a different rate of tax on luxury-type goods, where your upper earning part of the community should be paying more than the poor? So, you know, there is a whole host of factors to be taken into account.
Now it's that time to take a look at some of the practical considerations in the implementation of a new tax system. I asked all of our experts what are some of the problems and pitfalls that we in Malaysia need to be mindful of. Given their experiences all across the world, what are some of the key issues that we should strive to overcome? Michael Evans provides a quick overview.
There is issues in this whole debate as to what will business have to do, what type of issues arise as far as a business compliance perspective is concerned. There's government revenue issues and there's consumer issues and the burly legal disputes that arise are often about the transition. So Malaysia is more like Canada and New Zealand and Australia and what will happen shortly in China, because most other countries that have proceeded to a VAT system have already had some form of consumption tax in place, and you've got two, which actually makes it worse.
Now here's Professor Rod Hill with his two cents.
Perhaps two things come to mind. One is that you need a fair lead time to introduce this tax so that people, particularly small businesses, can figure out how the tax works and get their record-keeping and accounting systems ready so that the tax can be implemented without a lot of confusion. And then as well, issues of fraud are going to happen anywhere. I know that there have been examples in Canada as well where criminal organizations have set up fraudulent businesses, claimed GST credits, and made off with lots of money. In order for the system to work, you've got to have a pretty good enforcement and oversight system.
Speaking of fraud, here's a remarkable case of what went on in South Africa through fortune hunters and syndicates.
As far as risks are concerned, and this is also an international phenomenon, the minute a GST system is introduced, you will find, unfortunately, a number of fortune hunters, and some of these guys actually operate through international bodies or syndicates, where they would target countries where they implement VAT or GST. And the simplest way to actually get money out of the system is to quickly register as a taxpayer in that country and to submit a couple of VAT returns, obviously based on forged tax invoices, claim millions in refunds and then disappear. You know, it's often referred to as the missing vendor syndrome. And the reason why countries are very vulnerable in the beginning is you can just imagine the volume of applications for registrations to be processed ahead of the effective date.
But of course, fraud doesn't just come from without, but also from within. Dermot Gaffney warns us.
What we have seen in some developing countries is also, unfortunately, fraud from the revenue officials who collude with people by setting up a registration and submitting false GST returns that claim refunds. If you set them and claim small amounts at the beginning and then gradually increase them, the chances of scrutiny by the tax authority are small, and therefore people do get away with it, unfortunately. Europe has a particular issue where lots of money was fraudulent because of the internal European market and the way in which you transact from one EU member state to another. That's something that Malaysia would want to watch out for in the context of the ASEAN, you know, trading between countries with ASEAN member states. If you follow the European model, you can create what they call this carousel fraud, which is cost the European Union, I think the last estimate was something like 7 billion a year.
Corruption, fraud, and let's not forget profiteering. Robert Sang talks to us about some lessons from Singapore.
Singapore has had GST since 1994, so nearly 20 years of GST. And when it was introduced, there was also a lot of focus on anti-profiteering. So are businesses going to try and take advantage of the introduction of the tax to unfairly make a profit? The focus in Singapore about making sure that the anti-profiteering rules worked, in my view, were very successful and is something that the government here needs to learn from.
And finally, Feng Xiu from the Economist Intelligence Unit, who leaves us with some rather encouraging words.
In Malaysia's case, I would say that certainly our forecast going forward is that growth in Malaysia will remain around about the 5% mark, if not a little bit higher, going forward. So implementation, I don't see as a major problem. But going forward, it's just a matter of the government just trying to inform the public as much as possible of why they're doing it.
Which is precisely what we're doing right now. Because you've been listening to Here and Now in Malaysia, brought to you by the Economic Transformation Programme.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.